The problems of the New Haven Railroad are not unique nor exclusive. What is said here tonight reflects a disease that has already spread throughout the American railroads. Only a few have been spared. The rest are trying desperately to peer down the road ahead and recoiling at what they see. For if there is a remedy, it's lying unnoticed amid dwindling traffic and crushing costs. The transfusion for continued operations, railroaders say, had better be found soon, else we'll go the way of the ox cart and buggy. The woes of a hapless industry.
To more than 200,000 early rising commuters, these sounds are as commonplace as breakfast, toast, and coffee. These are a strange lot. Each day they speed from home to station to the world's most concentrated commuter center, New York City. This daily ebb and flow is one of the wonders of the railroading world. Railroad men come from scores of foreign countries to see it in operation. At the high points of the rush, there is less than a minute between trains. It is a schedule that is so tight that when the New Haven, which shares Grand Central Terminal with the New York Central, tries to squeeze one more train into this peak hour timetable, the schedules of more than 30 trains have to be juggled to make room. Mechanically, this is a picture of marvelous efficiency. But in every other respect, it is said to represent one of the worst messes in railroad history.
There are periods during the year when things break down, such as air conditioning and so forth, and having worked in factories and places where they do have equipment which, of course, is susceptible to breakdown, I can understand how these things do happen, and there's very little you can do about it except work hard to try to get it back into shape. I don't see how we can exempt the New Haven Railroad from mechanical breakdowns.
The railroad is obviously about 30 years behind the times. The cars are old, they're dirty. Nothing seems to function properly, with a few exceptions. They have been running on time a little better lately since they've gone into receivership. The cars are, as I say, very dirty. You find rips in the seats. You find seats that are completely unusable because of disrepair. The air conditioning only works in a few of the cars, apparently. It's simply an unpleasant way to travel. They should be kept cleaner. And if there's a possibility that more rapid transit lines can be set up, I think this should be considered.
I think the cars are very dilapidated. The seats are broken down. The floors are so bad that if you're not careful, you'll catch your heels in them. You can have a terrible accident.
Well, I think the time schedule has been met fairly well. I don't have any complaint that way. It's mainly the riding conditions, the air conditioning, and the cars themselves, which are pretty poor.
It was at the turn of the century when people began moving from the cities to the suburbs. And the railroads wanted their patronage to fill up the long-haul trains on the final leg of the journey. So the railroads offered them special rates, since the commuters could be absorbed in the normal traffic load. But as the Scarsdales, Winnetkas, Chestnut Hills, Palo Altos, Stamfords, and Coscobs developed, extra trains had to be put on, and the schedule began to sprout two lumps at either end of the day. The lumps gradually grew into peaks. Nobody knows exactly when the cost of supporting these peaks outran the income they provided. But for the New Haven, the 30s brought the first derailment. Outgoing President George Alpert tried to answer that question of what happened in 35. You made it then. Why can't you make it now?
I think the situation is entirely different. I think one of the troubles in the public mind, one of the things they don't understand, and many of the people in the political arena don't understand it from my conversations with them, is that the situation is drastically different today than it was in 1935. In 1935, this railroad had fixed charges which had grown up over the years. That is, interest on bonds and various issues of bonds and fixed charges of various kinds of $17.5 million a year. Now, at that time, the railroad was actually operating at a profit. Its net operations were in the black, about $8.5 million a year. So that in 12 years of reorganization, the court eliminated $11 million of those fixed charges. That is, it cut down the fixed charges from $17.5 million to $6.5 million. And since the company was operating in the black, it was able to absorb its fixed charges and be turned out into operation again. Now, today, the situation is different. Our fixed charges today, with all the things that have been said about the railroad, is only $6,700,000 a year, and a $3 or $4 million of that is on equipment trust certificates, which you can't touch at all. They're mortgages on our equipment, so that the best that can be hoped for in a scaling down of the fixed charges is maybe $3 million, maybe $4 million a year. But now the railroad, instead of operating at a profit, at a time now when we have the great highway network that's taken off all of much of our freight and passenger business and the airlines and all of that, today we're operating in the red rather than the black.
If we have done anything wrong, said J.P. Morgan to Theodore Roosevelt in 1903, send your man to my man and they can fix it up. The man that the elder Morgan wanted the President of the United States to send calling on his lawyer was the Attorney General of the United States. And the little matter he thought the two eminent counsel could fix up between them was an antitrust suit. The Sherman Antitrust Act put an end to such shenanigans and scored a victory for Roosevelt's trust-busting campaign. It marked the end of an era in which the railroads and their bankers could conduct their business with an arrogance that is still unique in the corporate annals of the land. Memories of that arrogance, best expressed and best remembered in William Vanderbilt's classic, The Public Be Damned, still linger in national memory. But if that era is over, another is about to begin. The search for the right transfusion to keep the railroads alive and running. A man of inflexible habits, a slave to the timetable, the modern-day commuter is often up before the farmers and into bed before his teenage sons. A single glance at his schedule can make him break off the most scintillating conversation in the city or leave his wife in the midst of an embrace. He dashes for the train with seconds to spare, boards it daily at the same precise spot on the platform, sits in the same seat. To preserve his privacy, he uses a newspaper like a shield, or he plays cards with the same partners. If he reads a sexy book or a left-wing newspaper, it is prudently concealed between more respectable pages. To hundreds of these commuters, the New Haven seems to have little cause for complaint. Every morning and evening, they board coaches filled to capacity. They pay a steady monthly fee and travel over tracks that they are convinced the New Haven would have to use for through traffic to New York anyway. In 1955, the New Haven carried over 44 million passengers. In 1959, only 34 million. It is obvious that people just don't ride the rails the way they used to.
Most of the public today, especially going into New York City or a city like Boston, where the parking problems are the way they are, the highways are overcrowded. I think if the public was given the proper service, clean cars, and cut down on the fares if necessary, it would help a great deal to bring people back to riding the railroads.
New Haven conductor Norman Whitley has been riding the rails since he was in knee pants. With over 21 years on the New Haven, he's witnessed a good deal of the outcry from disgruntled commuters. Norm, do you feel there has been a marked change in the way things are run on the New Haven?
We have a lot of late trains running, and especially during the commuter rush hours. If there's any breakdown of service at all ahead of these other trains, they just back right up against one another. I've seen as high as 12, 14 trains lined up trying to get in or get out of New York, because one train has been broke down, and there doesn't seem to be the proper coordination to get things rolling the way it was in the olden days. We had way more trains running than they have today, and still things ran along very smooth.
Well, couldn't some of these tie-ups have been prevented?
A train dispatcher doesn't have a free hand like he had in the olden days. A train conductor doesn't have a free hand. In the old days, a train conductor had any difficulty on the road, he'd go to a telephone, call the train dispatcher, tell him what was wrong, tell him what he could do in the shortest length of time to facilitate any tie-ups. But today, the train dispatcher would have to get some other official on the phone, and if he's not available, then you might sit there for quite a while. Now, we had a case here a couple of weeks ago coming out of New York where an automobile driver racing on the highway, the city streets of New York, come through a fence down in the cut, down on the railroad tracks, burst into flames. Unfortunately, the man got killed. We had two trains tied up. We lay there for a good 2.5 hours, not moving anywhere, on a four-track railroad, where all we'd have had it done was back our train back 2 miles, cross over at a crossover signal station, and proceed on another track, which we finally did after laying there 2.5 hours. The thing is that there was no one around with authority that could authorize making the move.
If commuters need the railroads, most railroad men are sure that they can do without the commuter. The New Haven lost $8.4 million on them last year. Former New Haven President George Alpert says the solution lies in an all-out campaign for government subsidies. He cites the example that the government gave more than $2 million in 1958 subsidies to New York's Airway Helicopter Service, which carried fewer passengers all year than the New Haven carries in a single day. But if the solution lies in subsidy, it also lies with getting the people back on the trains. Many lines have replaced obsolete equipment by borrowing money. 3 months ago, commuters waiting at the Northwestern's Ford Sheridan station were speechless when a brand new commuter train pulled in. Like urchins examining a new Cadillac, they climbed aboard, bounced on the soft seats, gazed in wonder at the fluorescent lighting. When the train started off, they noticed that the new type of brake it employed, while safer, had an unfamiliar squeak. Muttered one, "You'd think that they'd have brakes that didn't squeak on equipment as expensive as this." Said another, "Yeah, is that what our last fare increase went for? It's a hell of a way to run a railroad." On October 23rd, 1935, Federal Court Judge Carol Hinks approved a petition for reorganization of the New Haven under Section 77 of the National Bankruptcy Act. The railroad skidded to a virtual standstill. The operating assistant to the vice president at that time was John F. Doolin. Up from the ranks, John Doolin had worked as a clerk, yardmaster, night crew dispatcher, train rules examiner, chief crew dispatcher, chief clerk to the superintendent, all the way up to eventually becoming executive vice president under F.C. Dumaine Sr. in 1949. John, the incessant chatter of commuter complaints has no doubt become a matter of concern to everyone connected with the railroad. How was it when you were active in management?
In all my experience in connection with operation on the New Haven Railroad, even though we went through wars and depressions and hurricanes and all other serious problem periods, we never allowed the quality of our service to go down below an acceptable minimum for passengers and for freight. We would not operate dirty cars. We would never operate, of course, we don't now operate unsafe cars. But those standards were maintained. We had no complaints in those days. We just cleaned them. We had to clean them.
We've heard that the intent of the law prescribes that primary consideration be given to necessary service. Wasn't maintenance an important function under the first receivership?
Even though we were in bankruptcy from 1935 to 1947, we still had a safe operation, clean cars, efficient service, good service, and courteous service in bankruptcy.
Delays will occur, but isn't the railroad responsible to inform its passengers?
It's a standard rule of every railroad book in the United States that when passenger service is disarranged or delayed, that the passengers must be informed. And even to the point where if a thing like that happened in the morning before a passenger got to the station and they were going to be seriously delayed, you try not let him get out of his automobile. If you could get word to them by a loudspeaker, police department, local police department, or anybody else could get the help and say, serious delay, trains will not operate, and so forth, then they could stay in their car and go to New York, or they'd go anywhere they wanted, go home. But you wouldn't let them stand around. Now, all of those things are possible to do, see? And those are the things that you've learned all your life. You hope that you will do them at the appointed time. Just the same as a good shortstop knows when he gets a ball and there's a guy on first and he's heading for a second, there's only one out, he's going after that double play, and it's almost automatic. And it ought to be just the same way with good operating men.
Connecticut was slow to become excited over railroads. With her coast of a quiet sea and good harbors fringing on its boundary, with its navigable river crossing it in the opposite direction, another penetrating deeply into it, with one of the finest systems of turnpike roads in the country, one could understand why there was a lack of enthusiasm. She needed no better connection with New York. She was right next door. President Timothy Dwight of Yale noted in his memoirs in 1821 that 6 good turnpikes sprayed out from New Haven, and the coach service was considered superb. Yet even when the railroad was in operation only from New Haven to Meriden, it was, if you can believe it, declared by New Haven papers to be decidedly the best and most popular route in the winter season between New York and Albany. In December 1838, a traveler would come up to New Haven by boat, take the train which departed when the boat arrived, usually about 1 o'clock, then had to get off at Meriden because the line through to Hartford was not yet complete. He waited in Meriden till 10 o'clock that night for another coach, and with luck was scheduled to arrive at Albany at 3 o'clock in the afternoon the next day, a trip that took about 32 hours. But that was in December of 1838, and it took another year to finish the rails to Hartford, 18 miles more. Patrick B. McGinnis was a senior partner in the New York investment firm of McGinnis & Company when F.C. Dumaine Sr. passed on. A struggle for control ensued between F.C. Dumaine's son and McGinnis. McGinnis's group emerged victorious and took over control and management of the New Haven on April 16, 1954. We asked Patrick McGinnis just where he was taking the New Haven Railroad.
One of the great difficulties of the railroads, as against industry generally, is that we didn't have enough plans as to where we were going. And of course, most railroad executives said, well, we haven't got the money, what's the use of planning? As a result, you got into a paradox. I had long-range plans on the New Haven in 1955 to rearrange the signals so that these automatic trains would operate.
Well, then, just where was the turning point? And what about these inequities and inequalities?
We certainly are operating under a great deal of inequities and inequalities, which you've been hearing about, taxes and trucks having no maintenance to amend, airlines being subsidized, and so forth. Nevertheless, I believe that the difficulty was that the turning point, I think, came in the middle 20s and was emphasized in the Depression, that we had people running the railroads who were operators. Most times we had as a chief executive an operator, a man who knew the railroad, who could operate it, but he was not a manager in the sense we understand it today, where a chief executive must discount what his competitors are doing. An operation by cubicle. Traffic was here, operations was here, law was here. As a result, when these tremendous competitions started to approach us, we had no chief executive who could say collectively, what are we going to do about it? As a result, we did nothing about it. And likewise, in these inequities that gradually enfolded us, we had no group of chief executives who could say our long-range plans are going to be ruined by these things that are happening. What are we going to do about it? That transition, I think, must occur where an operating man can no longer be accepted as being a good manager unless he's a good executive.
Mr. McGinnis, what happened to all these long-range plans?
A great many of these long-range plans, which I had, were not carried out. I do think that management could have reversed the direction of the New Haven Railroad by some very drastic application of long-range plans to correct what's down there. For example, on passengers, the New Haven is runs around 1,700 miles of railroad, and yet 85% of the passenger business is carried on 290 miles. My plans were to have the MTA in Boston go out to Route 128 and to have the New York subways go up into New Rochelle, Bridgeport, and take care of all of the commuting on a trackage right arrangement so that the New Haven Railroad passenger business would be carried on low center of gravity trains, which I bought three, running between New Rochelle and 128, 100 miles an hour, 2 hours, at low fares, and shuttling back and forth. And I would have abandoned the passenger business on 1,300 miles. Secondly, the freight business on the New Haven, 85% of the freight business is carried on 75% of the mileage, and I would have abandoned completely about 1,200 miles of this freight line because it's no longer necessary. I would have sold all the passenger stations. I would have sold all the freight stations because we don't need them anymore. Various other long-range plans, which I think could have been carried into effect and eventually must be carried into effect by someone in order to preserve a reason for existence. Now, I don't say that the campaign George Alpert made to acquaint the public with our problems was not a tremendous thing. Unfortunately, the public reaction was not quick enough to the problem to save it. But I think his missionary work will benefit all of the mass transportation problems in the United States, particularly in the East.
We note here that the three Telgo-type cars purchased by Mr. McGinnis cost $5 million. Of the three, only one, the Roger Williams, is in service today. It runs between Boston and Providence. The Dan Webster and the John Quincy Adams have been stored and are now still sitting, slightly weathered, at Cedar Hill in New Haven. The trustees have indicated that they intend to sell these remaining two cars, even at a loss. They have further revoked the contracts for the equipment. But the two cars can still be seen at Cedar Hill. Sleek, modern, but unusable on the present system. The human equation in railroading is the railroad man himself. He is actually something of a paradox. It would be difficult to find anywhere an employee with more loyalty to his company, more job interest and native resourcefulness, or one who occupies a more secure and respected niche in the community. Although the history of railroad workers has been colored by their attachment for the unions and a resultant demand for the nationalization of the railroad industry, the brotherhoods have appeared non-militant and willing to cooperate with management. The cooperative attitude and the lack of militancy are based solidly on a pragmatic policy of getting more and more for their members and preserving job control. The brotherhood's long-standing method for achieving goals has been the strike threat, followed by quiet but very effective political action. Tom Frederick Kelly is the Connecticut legislative representative for the Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen. Now, Tom, how does labor see the problems gripping the New Haven?
We think now that it's happened, that possibly the best thing that could happen in New Haven Railroad, for the simple reason that it may bring to light what is actually the basic problem on the Haven Railroad, which is not the passenger problem, but the freight service. Passenger problem in the last 10 years has not changed hardly at all. It's the freight problem that has been really the difference. The gross or net railway freight earnings on the Haven Railroad between 1950 and 55 was approximately $20 million a year. From 55 on, it started to slip. We're now down to less than $2 million a year. This is the basic problem. This is where the railroad is in trouble.
Where then do you feel all this money was going, Tom?
Well, along about 1955, McGinnis, Miss Cohart's, since came in here, and through their policy of waste and mismanagement and squandering of monies, there just wasn't enough monies left to give the proper service. When I say that, I mean that they brought in experts in here to reduce cost of operation. The experts had one job, and that was to cut the payroll. Now, regardless of the income or the service or anything else, they did cut the payroll. But at the same time, they practically wrecked the freight service. There's no question that the freight service across the country is declining in earnings, but not to the proportion of this railroad. And when I say wasted, he wasted fabulous sums. Stock deals, buying equipment that was unnecessary, not usable. He spent millions in this direction. He spent fabulous sums of money on his own personal pleasures, such as a private train running up down this railroad every day in the week, crews in service, on full pay at all times. Building penthouses there that run into $100,000. And same thing in New York, the hotels, big fabulous suites and such. I don't think that this railroad, as much money as it ever made, could survive under conditions like that. First, the entire story of this is on record. Came out in both PUC hearings in 1960 and ICC hearings, which were held in New Haven in 1960. Mr. Paola, the ICC, wrote a report on the history of the Haven Railroad, and he spells most all this out in there, just where the money was wasted and how it was wasted.
And what about the future of the New Haven?
We think basically the one thing that this new management or trustees have got to take into consideration and keep in their mind at all times that the Haven Railroad has but one product to sell, and that's service. We've got to change our schedules, we've got to change our mode of operation to fit the need of the customer. Once we do that, and I feel assured, as our argument does, that if we give service, then we can get our business back. And of course, basically, as I said before, the freight business is the bread and butter of this railroad.
Another active labor leader is George Cahill, general chairman of the Railroad Trainmen New Haven System. George, no study of any railroad can overlook the claim of feather bedding. Among the classic examples is the tale about the fireman who doesn't tend any fires. What functions then does he have on the diesels of today?
Well, a fireman performs many essential functions on a train. His main function is a lookout for signals to look the train over. He is on there for safety reasons. And then on top of that, he performs many other mechanical functions, such as checking boilers on passenger trains. And if there are any minor repairs to be made while moving, the fireman is qualified to carry these out.
Whenever make-work rules are discussed, union representatives quite understandably seek to minimize their impact on the railroad industry. And I hope that you don't chide me for calling attention to a few isolated examples. The unfortunate part of the story is that examples are anything but isolated, and when taken together, they constitute a tremendous financial load. Aren't make-work or featherbed rules to be found on all railroads?
There are no so-called featherbed rules in train service. This term was dreamed up and is being used by incompetent and non-competitive railroad officials to make up for their own inequities. The railroad officials of today do not realize that the railroad is a competitive form of business. They now must meet other forms of transportation on a competitive basis. They can't sit back like they sat back years ago when there was only one form of transportation, which was the railroads. Today you have the seas, the seaways, you have the air lanes, and you also have the trucks, which have taken much of our business away because of the highways built by the government and the states.
Since we had planned to give ample opportunity for both sides to voice their opinions to any issue, we attempted at this point to secure a spokesman for management. However, with the emergence of new management and a cautious wait-and-see policy, we were unable to complete this pro and con argument. We note here that in the book Outlook for the Railroads by Poyntz Tyler, there is a case of argument worth noting, and we quote, "In stating their case for the firemen on diesels, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen and Enginemen make much of his alleged value as a safety factor and a second pair of eyes. This argument ignores the fact that there are not two but three men on U.S. freight locomotives. Any lookout or safety function of the diesel fireman therefore duplicates the work of the forward trainman, who handles this duty quite adequately since he also rides the locomotive cab." End of quote. We asked George Cahill about the future and a suggestion for the new management.
The New Haven's big problem today is to increase their freight business, and their one item is fast, efficient service. They must remember, as I said before, that it's a competitive field, and the only way that they can compete with the trucks, which I know they can, is to make it a fast service. A freight train, say, carrying 50 freight cars with a crew of three trainmen and two engine personnel, which is only five men, certainly could carry this freight cheaper than 50 trailer trucks, which would take 50 drivers.
After 75 years, the American railroad era had reached the fullness of its being. By the turn of the century, it was an institution, an image of man, a tradition, a code of honor, a source of poetry, a nursery of boyhood desires, and the most solemn machine that marks the epochs in man's life, with the exception of a funeral hearse. No wonder that songs and tales gathered as the tracks went further west. Casey Jones, The Wreck of the Old 97. No wonder that even today, children's books and toys present the steam engines and go so far as to present one as being almost human, with Sparky and the talking train. Grown-ups, book and record makers, designers of toys and the buyers of gifts cannot bring themselves to admit that this inheritance has all but gone. There is no question that we need the New Haven Railroad. We need all railroads. In an already crowded sky, disasters are piling up, and airline executives, caught in a dilemma beyond their control, can hardly sleep nights for the cold fear of wondering where and when tragedy will strike next. And on the ground, another dilemma, the one we all know best. Our highways are too crowded, and they're getting worse. The auto is an inefficient commuter tool, carries only an average 1.7 commuters. Soviet Premier Khrushchev, inspecting crowded San Francisco highways, exclaimed what we all know to be too true. What a waste. Fred Waterhouse, president of the Connecticut Manufacturers Association, summed up Connecticut's industry feeling on the New Haven.
We have to sympathize with them and try to help them out because we need them. We just must have the railroad there. So many things that must go by rail that, in all practical purposes, they can't go by truck. The heavy materials and equipment, the basic raw materials. As a matter of fact, you probably don't realize it, but there are carload after carload of fresh fruit and vegetables come to Connecticut every day, and from long hauls. And of course, that's not our province, but that indicates the necessity, not only to us, but to the people of Connecticut, of continuing the New Haven Railroad as a part of our transportation system.
The Connecticut State Chamber of Commerce was not going to sit idly by and see the railroad die. A railroad study committee was formed in August to study the problems and offer help. The chairman of that committee is Frank Reinhold, retired vice president of the Connecticut Light and Power Company. Mr. Reinhold, how does your committee see the New Haven problem?
We see it like this. In talking with many industrialists, we get the answer that no matter what happens, we've got to have a railroad. Now, starting on that premise, we are endeavoring in every way we know how by cooperating with the trustees to see that service such as it presently exists, freight service I'm referring to, is continued and, if possible, improved. Now, unless industry is able to come up with additional tonnage of freight, both inbound and outbound, for the railroad, we cannot hope that freight service, which incidentally, in general, is excellent, can hope to continue or be improved. There's also the point that freight service as such here on the New Haven in normal times can carry its weight all right. It's the passenger service that has been the heavy drag on the overall problems of finance and the New Haven Railroad.
The decade before World War II saw the beginnings of airport and airway development from public funds. This socialization was claimed to be justifiable as public policy toward an infant industry and was augmented by great operating subsidy payments to most, if not all, of the airlines. The Congressional Conference report dated August 18, 1959, which accompanied a House report refusing additional appropriations for cargo aircraft development, said, and we quote, "Civilian aviation has grown by virtue of the generous subsidy it has received from the government. It is a giant grown fat by government subsidies and high rate charges." End of quote. To match their prices, the railroads have had an increasing economic problem. The last decade and a half has brought the dieselization of most of the railroad operations in the country. Great developments in centralized traffic control, electronic classification yards, mechanized maintenance and freight handling. All of this self-improvement averaged more than $1 billion a year and was made in a period of inflation when traffic volume was declining and whose net result, particularly on the New Haven, was an economic weakening rather than an improvement. Public sponsorship of highway facilities, government maintenance, government policing, government snow removal, government ice sanding, and government signaling makes it incredibly easy for the bus and truck operators to compete with the railroads. One man who probably understands this best is Gardner Caverly, executive vice president of the New England Council. Mr. Caverly, before George Alpert left control of the New Haven, he cited the council for its report on what he labeled deficient understanding of the problem. He further said that your report overlooked his claim for a need for tax relief.
No, that factor was not overlooked at all. In fact, just for the record, let's we go back to the preface of the New England Council's report itself, and let me quote very briefly. "Each of the states affected by the current New Haven financial crisis has shouldered its responsibility by affording tax relief, which the New England Council has constantly recommended as one necessary step in restoring the economic health of the railroad. The tax relief is an important step toward any ultimate solution of the railroad's financial crisis, but it is not an end of itself. The granting of tax relief does, however, underscore the vital stake of the public in the maintenance of this essential facility." So you'll see by that, that even in the preface of the report, we very definitely call to the attention the need of this tax relief on the part of the states.
Well, wasn't federal relief felt to be an adequate solution to the New Haven?
I think possibly what we're concerned with here more than anything else, or what the New England Council is concerned with, is the steps whereby the New Haven, in their request of federal financial aid, could very well lead not only to the New Haven, but to other railroads seeking the same type of relief, which in turn, if you will, would ultimately lead to the nationalization not just alone of our New England and national railroads, but in addition to that of all other forms of transportation of this country. In other words, I think here is a council dedicated as it is to private enterprise, feeling that here, asking for federal relief, we know that this federal relief cannot be made available, else the federal government is going to want a certain amount of control, not only in the New Haven, as I've said, but in other railroads. In short, we here in New England, if socialization, or nationalization rather, of our American railroads are going to take place, we do not propose to let it start right here in New England.
Your report called for reorganization. Yet Alpert says, and I quote, "Reorganization would not eliminate the huge passenger deficits." Were you largely blaming New Haven management?
The question that I would immediately raise there is, what do you mean by largely? I think that probably some managerial ineptitude, and this goes over several different managements that the New Haven has had recently, I feel that they probably, at least to some part, have contributed to the downfall of the New Haven, and yet certainly not by itself is management solely responsible for the condition facing the New Haven today. I think that it was pointed out in the Interstate Commerce Commission report that the present management, the recent management of the New Haven, had failed to develop any long-term plans for the future of the railroad. And yet, in defense of that management, I would point out that because of the crises, the ever-present crises, and the lack of cash, undoubtedly this management was spending most of their time with this hand-to-mouth existence, wondering where they would get cash enough to operate for next week. And with a setup of that sort, of course, it would be impossible for them to probably devote the time necessary to develop one of these long-range plans.
What about the future? What's to be done?
My own feeling is that probably management failed in presenting too little, too late. It did not take the strong, major, bold step necessary to solve the problems of the New Haven, because this is something that it requires something more than a Bromo-Seltzer, if you will, to solve the problems of the New Haven. We may very well find ourselves in a situation that the patient requires major amputation. And if you will go back over the last 10 years of the operation of the New Haven Railroad, you will discover, I believe, that only some 50 miles of railroad has been abandoned during that length of time. I think one of the great problems facing the present, the future management of the New Haven is to shrink this transportation facility to the size needed in today's economy.
Probably Connecticut's most informed public official on the problem of the New Haven is Eugene Lucklin, chairman of the Public Utilities Commission. Earlier in the year, he had served on an interstate committee to study ways and means of preventing what proved to be inevitable, bankruptcy. He outlines a few of those plans.
We developed a plan which, in our opinion, would have preserved the New Haven Railroad and permitted it to continue as a going concern. This tax relief was one of the elements of that plan. A fare increase was another one. That took place, of course. And then a $3 million relief on the excise taxes, federal excise taxes, that was another element that never was voted by Congress. And then a reduction through economies or any other way in the management and labor. If we got that amount of money, which would amount to something over around $13,700,000 a year, relief for the New Haven Railroad, it is possible that the railroad will be able to continue as a going concern. But all that was resulted in that program was $6,200,000 in tax relief.
Mr. Laughlin, has all this effort to save the railroad been in vain? Is the New Haven worth saving?
Of course, the greatest proof of need is use. And the New Haven is being used to in many of the categories of passenger traffic. Certainly the freight is being used. Some of the branch lines in freight, there may be some question as to whether or not they are paying the out-of-pocket cost to transport that freight over the railroad. But the freight on those lines, no matter how small it is supplying factories with raw materials, and those raw materials are giving work to Connecticut people, and which is very important. Without the freight lines and without the certain branch lines, it probably might mean that some of those factories would have to leave Connecticut. It also might mean that Connecticut would not be able to attract new industry into the state in those particular territories. And those particular territories are probably the most important territories that Connecticut ought to be developing. In the last war, although Connecticut was down near the bottom of all the states insofar as size is concerned, I believe they were either 7th or 12th in the production of the war material. If we ever have another national emergency or another war, the railroad is going to be most important. When you realize that we are at the northeastern part of the country, more or less isolated from the rest of the country, if you please, we are a terminal for all the other railroads, and they certainly can't ship anything in, they can't ship it out to the northeast or to certain parts of Canada without coming into New England. It's just beyond comprehension what would happen to New England in general and Connecticut in particular if we didn't have a railroad.
In his memorandum commenting on the appointment of trustees for the New Haven, Federal District Court Judge Robert P. Anderson said, "What is called for is a well-balanced team composed of individuals with the appropriate skills, the technical know-how to operate the New Haven Railroad, the capacity to formulate new and constructive ideas in seeking out a solution of these unprecedented problems, who will also command the respect and confidence of the officers and employees of the New Haven Railroad, the customers of the road, the officials of the government involved, and the general public." Judge Anderson selected three trustees, each experienced in his respective field, each selected with a view to their functioning as a team. If this is the brain power that is needed to detonate a return to solvency for the New Haven, we can only hope that it succeeds. As the operating trustee, Judge Anderson chose Harry W. Darrigan, once himself an operating man on the New Haven.
Of course, we're looking forward to the possibility of being able to reorganize this railroad under private capital. Whether that can be accomplished, we're still studying. We are attacking the problem of increasing our revenues, especially in the freight side. We have met with industrial groups, and we are hopeful that the result of these meetings and what they're doing along the line of assisting will produce a better gross revenue for the railroad. Our problem with respect to the service we've been providing is one of cash. We would like to provide better service. We have attempted to improve it slightly, especially along the lines of our passenger equipment, but we're restricted by the amount of cash and money available to do the things that we would like to do. The end result is that we can only provide the service, especially for the commuter passenger business, which the public are going to determine is necessary in the public interest. And that service, when it is provided, will have to be supported in such a way by the public through the legislative representatives, both federal, state, and municipal, so that the railroads will be paid for the service that they determine should be continued in operation. Under those conditions, we believe that the railroad could be restored to the service of years ago, the equipment better maintained, and the cleanliness of it improved, and those things cost money.
Trustee Richard J. Smith is a specialist in public utility and corporate reorganization law, and among other things, is a regular commuter on the New Haven.
The situation with respect to the operation of this railroad is so critical that the solution must be found early to avoid real disaster. For that reason, we trustees are bending every effort to galvanize the activities of public authorities and to step up the internal work of our own organization so that within the coming year, we can have a crystallized plan for satisfactory future operation of railroad service in southern New England. I have been riding the trains of the New Haven Railroad into New York City for more than 25 years, almost daily. I have noted the sad and continuous deterioration of the equipment and the service, especially since the end of World War II. The public generally have taken the attitude that some miracle is going to continue railroad service into New York City. In this respect, they may have contributed to the deterioration of the service. It is only by realizing their stake in the service and by insisting that their public representatives participate in the rehabilitation of passenger service into New York City that that will be possible.
And the financial expert on the team is William J. Kirk, who has a long list of associations with financial counseling and managerial organizations. In his charge to the new appointees, Judge Anderson said, if adequate time is not afforded to solve these difficult problems, or if in the light of economic circumstances, no way can be found to make income and the cost of operations meet, the New Haven Railroad will simply have to go out of business. The court is aware that the trustees cannot assure anyone of the success of their endeavors. It will need the cooperation of many others. But the court is of the opinion that if these individuals, with that cooperation, cannot find a solution, it is probable that there is no solution to be found.
New Haven Last Stop was written and produced by Paul Gianfrido. The narrator was Dick Bertel. Program engineer was Bill Lobb. We are grateful for the assistance of Bob McKernan and Al Fields of the New Haven Railroad and to everyone who contributed to this program.
A WTIC Public Affairs production.